Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things with Bryce Castillo.
Hello, everybody.
Brian stifling a sneeze, Brushwood.
The worst part was I hit the mute button and then nothing came out. So as far as anybody watching goes, I just did an impression of a rabbit.
Well, and I'm Andrew Main.
Hi, Andrew.
Oh, I sneeze at will because I have total, complete control. It's not true. And it's worse, you're like, oh, okay, it's going to come back. And then it never does.
Hey, man, what are we working on today?
So I want to talk about a couple things. Did you see the announcement where Elon Musk unveiled the semi, the Tesla semi?
Not since we last did. You did mention that it was worth watching. We talked through the broad strokes, but if there's a detail that I haven't heard about, I'd love to hear it.
Well, they unveiled the pricing, so that's what happened since then. As they say, it's going to like $150,000 and like $180,000 for this thing.
Yeah, dude, that's like just get that and instead of a house, just get
that. And live in it.
Yeah, man. And tow your house around?
Dude, and then just, I'm so there. Well, tow your roadster around there because it can be like Knight Rider. It's problem solved.
Oh, my God.
So now the latest – I'm getting to a point here. And it's not going to be an Elon Musk episode for those of you that are sick of us hearing us talk about this. But I got my boring company hat, by the way. He got permission from L.A., then discussions with Los Angeles County, et cetera, to continue expanding. They're applying for permits to expand their tunnel way north, way more expansions, like all the way to the valley. They're applying to be able to do this. And the city and the county or whatever have been very, very cooperative with this. They're very eager to let him try this experiment. He thinks in a couple like a year or two's time, he thinks he can have the tunnel going from where it is in Hawthorne, maybe all the way up into the San Fernando Valley, which is where I live. And this is a test tunnel.
How many of the tunnels have been done at this point?
Well, he's done like something like 300 or 500 feet so far.
Okay.
So he's dug that far so far, and he seems to be confident enough to expand this little hobby even further. And what he's talking about is people are like, well, we have tunnels, but it's a 3D network of tunnels. It's not just a tunnel. With this technology, if you can lower the cost, we dig a tunnel from here to there, and people are like, oh, we do that highways, and people still want to use them. Yeah, if you want to add another highway, it takes you 20 years, and you don't have any place to put it. You want to dig another tunnel here, you dig it below the other tunnel. Want to add another tunnel? Go below. Want another one?
So in other words, it's like a whole honeycomb network of warrens, basically, underground.
Yeah, so you could do that. So anyhow, so that's moving forward. We'll see. And he's got permission also on the East Coast to do some more test tunnels. There's a lot of enthusiasm to try this. We'll see what happens, but it's gone way further than you know, anybody's expected. Okay. Unveils a semi, unveils this. Meanwhile, looks like there's more enthusiasm with the defense industry as far as the big Falcon rocket. A lot of these things are happening. So he's got, and then he hit. Hold on for this. Wait one moment.
Uh-oh.
He's gotten up.
He struck gold. He was digging, and he hit gold. Oh, on the cover of Rolling Stone, yeah.
The Architect of Tomorrow, the cover says. 25 people shaving the next
By the way, years. quick reminder, this is not an episode about Elon Musk. So we're clear.
This is about Rolling Stone.
This is gathering stones that roll.
Here's where I'm getting. Here we are. It's almost December. The year's almost up. New Year's is coming up. And we're all kind of, I think, of the mentality New Year's resolutions are sort of BS. But there is a time for New Year's introspection. Oh. Right?
Yeah.
And you look at somebody like him and you go, you know, this guy's kind of like firing on all cylinders. Probably not a lifestyle anybody would really want to have if you live it. And he probably finds himself way overcommitted. Jeff Bezos hit the 100 billion. He's now like down to like 99.6 right now.
Boo.
You know, sir, his wife is like, no, I'm going to kiss you when you're at 100 billion. I'm sorry. Bezos has spent his life building a big company, being very intelligent. Both of these guys are very scientific in how they build things and how they approach these things. These guys understand scientific method, et cetera. This is happening. I want to talk about the concept of, you say, what should you shoot for? What should you do? Leveling up. How do you level up?
Man, it's tough because the first step is the hardest one, which is to make an honest assessment of what is it you do, how do you do it, how much of it is trading your time for money, how much of it could be done by other people. And you'll notice like one of the Robert Kiyosaki books talks about gives a fable or a parable of two entrepreneurs, and they're both tasked with bringing water to a village. And one of them, dude, runs out, grabs three buckets, runs 1 mile out to the lake, scoops up the bucket, comes back, starts selling them for $3 a pail, and he just thinks life is the best thing ever. And he's making $3 a bucket and just running as fast as he can. And in fact, he's even able to hire some other people to run buckets back and forth and all that stuff. The other dude does nothing for 5 years. Instead, he sketches plans, he interviews, he hires architects, loses tons of money as they draw up plans, and then eventually builds a pipeline that just starts, you know, sending water constantly nonstop right up to the town, and he charges 3 cents per bucket of water. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, that one guy who moved very, very quickly, but essentially was just trading his time for money, had a system that could not scale. There was no way to go up from where he was. And overnight, he went from being the only game in town to completely out of business because he didn't future-proof and think about ways to scale. And so I, in previous periods of introspection, when I was on tour in my early 30s, I was like, I hit a point of complete saturation where I had as many shows and was spending as much time on the road as I was comfortable doing anymore, and I would be taking away from the family. The money was good, and I was like, well, maybe I should just start increasing the price. But the market I was in, I couldn't, you know, elevate beyond a certain price point that would change their budgets. And so I had to start thinking like the guy running a pipeline and not like the guy running a bucket back and forth. So if you want to be, you know, not an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos, but you want to be closer to them than you are right now, then you got to think like where, you know, that line from Fight Club, waste is a thief. You know, where are you being stolen from? Where's waste in your system? And, you know, for me at the time, once I had a budget, it's like, well, let me start outsourcing more of the graphic design work, of the of the marketing campaigns and all that stuff. Let me invest more time in a way to reach more people by pitching this Scam School show. And then, you know, once Scam School started getting somewhere, it's like, well, let me figure out how I can put even more time out there. I've got to develop the skills of learning how to talk under a microphone. So let me start doing the BB Live show and stuff. And it, you know, it's been, you know, a 12 year journey to pivot from being a bucket carrier to getting closer to that, you know, that other side of things. So, but along that journey, you know, it's always scary to make bets. It's always scary to invest money and capital resources and call favors on your friends. But of everything for me, the hardest part was that core assessment of what am I doing and where do I want to be?
I think it's a very interesting analogy, and it's one of those things that you have to sort of tell people too, because I have friends that would tell you, oh, I'm planning to build a pipeline. It's like, you ain't doing jack. If you're Elon Musk, you would start the bucket system and use that to fund the pipeline, but you'd know what the hell you're doing, you know, and that's the thing. You knew what you're doing. I had the same sort of epiphany with you. Like, I'm out doing shows, and I'm like, what is my business? And I said, oh, my business is selling shows. Do I want to be in the business of selling entertainment and shows like this and live shows? I'm like, no, I don't. If I want to be in the business of selling live shows, then I need to just take me out of the situation and sell shows, sell other entertainers, package that, become a show producer like that.
And by the way, I watched a lot of people make that transition, is they maxed out their schedule and all these schools were like, well, what else can you give us? And it's like, well, I don't have time to write another show for you for the fall semester, but you can hire my so-and-so friend. And then they start realizing that the thing of value that they really built was the network of contacts and the reputation for delivering quality performances.
So I did that with TV. You know, I went out and pitched my own magic show, and, you know, I did a pilot and it was under option. I'm like, while I wait, why don't I create other shows? And so I sold stuff to Lionsgate and G4 and Cartoon Network and other places. And I said, okay, I can create other ideas for shows and then play that game of maybe one of them catches on and becomes big or whatever. But then it's, you know, I still create and do that, you know, because I have a partner that I work with. But, you know, you have to realize what you're in a lot of different businesses. You can say, what do you want your business to be? And I said, well, part of my business is my creativity, and I could write books. And so I did that and putting stuff under option and things like that. But you have to ask yourself, what business are you in? And using Scott Adams' example, what do you have energy for? Energy is a very, very critical thing. Not passion, but energy.
Although I would say that passion is an ingredient. Energy is the total amount of output that you can do. And passion is one of the vectors that fuels your energy. If you lack passion, then you will have less energy for a thing than if you do have passion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And I guess his point was sort of saying, is, you know, we're passionate about a lot of things, but energy is the thing you just get up and you'll go do. Mm-hmm. And obviously there has to be a passion there, but passion alone isn't enough. I look at how I've been doing my time management, and I'm horrible. I know I need a certain amount of time to let my brain refresh. I know I have to have a certain amount of time to let my brain sort of just, you know, reset and stuff like this. So I understand that, like, yeah, I can't sit in front of my computer 18 hours a day and just write books. That would not be productive. And so that's why I do other things. And now I've got a couple big projects right now that are like, okay, these are the important ones. I will spend X amount of time on this, X amount of time on this, X amount of time on this. But I'm going to take time away from where I would normally people go out and hang out on a Friday night. I take time away from watching Netflix shows and I'll put it towards a project. And that for me has been, how do I level up? I level up by focusing on a couple things, partnering with people that are can help make these things happen, and walking away when I know that thing is dead.
That's the hard one, man. The walking away when you know the thing is dead is everyone's excited at the beginning of a thing and the promise, mm-hmm. but the money's made and knowing when to stop.
Well, and I think that – so I'll give you an example. So what I can tell you about The Naturalist right now is Amazon Publishing, Thomas and Mercer was my publisher for that, bought two more books. That got released. That got announced. So I have a book coming out in March, which is already written, already ready to go. And then I have to deliver another book in April, another book at some other point beyond that. And I'll probably have both those books written before April, right? So I'm in the publishing role. I've got that thing going on. And there's some other stuff, The Naturalist, that interesting things there. But I say, okay, I could just say, okay, that's great. I could just focus on that, maybe do another Station Breaker book, whatever. I started writing a new series, an entirely new series and I said, what do I know now about what I did before? And not a Naturalist is really, it's a start of life as a bigger property perhaps, but there's only so much I can do at this point. I've sort of done what I can do there. It's sort of launched and now I can just sort of wait and say, okay, great. Let me enjoy the rewards of this. Or like I did, I spent this weekend working on the next series because I've now got people who want to buy that one and, you know, do things with it, which is cool. And because I said, you know what, instead of waiting for this thing to peter out or just to see what, you know, the do it, like just do the next thing, get into the next thing.
Yeah. Well,
and it's not even for self-employed and creative people. Even if you're working at a 9-to-5 job or whatever, you know, a lot of the best advice or the way to move up is to quit your job and to move up to a non-lateral position.
Within
reason, this I'm not selling people to go and quit their job.
Well, right. But I guess what I was thinking of, because the moment you said
especially
that,
especially if you're a podcast producer,
the moment you said that, I was thinking about folks who are in 9-to-5 jobs. And in that case, it's not an individual entrepreneur. People who work in any large corporation should understand you're still an entrepreneur. You're just playing your entrepreneurial game within a set structure. So if you're in management, you have a team. So you ask that same question of your team, like where is the landscape headed? What is going to cause this team to get folded up and no longer be relevant because some other team is going to be working on or how is the marketplace shifting where this will be irrelevant or whatever? Yeah. And how can I get ahead of it? And so you still do your bucket carrying 9-to-5 job and your team provides, or whether your team is, you know, a team of one, you know, you show up and you type in, you know, the receipts and now you've done it. Yeah. That's what
every office job is.
It's been a while. It's been a hot minute. or like you go and you answer the phone queue or whatever, yeah. But like Andrew was saying, within the confines of that, you can see where stuff is headed And you can provide value preemptively by you know, working on a side project. What Google calls it their, 20% time or something like that?
Yeah.
Where it's like whether your company gives you that 20% time, decide that you owe it to yourself and your career to take it to give yourself 20% time. Just put the 20% on top. Just decide you'll work 20% harder than everyone else.
Be careful about allocating existing time.
Yes. But I mean, just do that same 20% time. Just decide you're going to work just 20% harder than everyone else, and you're going to do it on speculative projects that could transform your role in the corporate work, transform the importance of your team if you have a team, give you a team if you don't. But it's like your boss. Your boss's boss is when you come up and make a proposal, you're like, this is speculative. If you've got some cash, I could do this on the side and we could see how it, you know, what it yields for the company. And then meanwhile, you're building another asset of value to where, you know, there are people who sometimes they invest their 20% time coming up with ideas that renders their 9-to-5 job useless. There's a friend of mine who built the entire, every email sent out, every reply. But there's a widget company.
Jason Damon.
There's a company that sells widgets, and they've got a system for every single thing to go through. There is not one email either way that is not pre-written.
It's all automated?
It takes a light touch. Like you receive the incoming email, you know what part of the sales process you're at, so you don't write a response to move somebody from interest to, you know, attention and all that stuff. Instead, you just say, okay, well, this guy is in this demographic. I'm going to send him this email. And once all that's written, it's on rails, and the guy wrote everything, and he's like, well, now there's nothing left for me to do for you, which on the one hand, like, boo-hoo, he's not at that company anymore. Yeah. But on the other hand, he now gets to be a self-employed entrepreneur who has a track record of like, I build systems for large companies that takes them from $1 million a year to $10 million a year. And now I could just do that again for everyone. And then I could sell my system to somewhere else. So I don't know. It's be future focused. You know, it's that whole be where the puck's going to be, not where it is.
Yeah.
So my side project over a year ago was AuthorPage. Right? Mm-hmm. AuthorPage was the site I created to make, because I'm like, oh man, it's hard to make just like an easy, I just want an easy way to create a web page for myself, whatever. So I went through the work, created this sort of template sort of thing, runs on Rails, whatever like that. And I just free to other authors. I've got over like 100 authors on AuthorPage right now.
Oh, that's great.
And I have not done any coding on this in probably months. I check on it periodically. Now, if I just sent Bryce a link, and every now and then I'm still doing beta invites, like if you email me like this. So I sent a link. So here's a guy writing in Hindi. If you scroll down there, click on one of those books.
Sure. Here we've got Hari Janani.
Wow. So I had no idea. This was just somebody. I said, hey, yeah, sure. I just said he got an invite to use it. And now I've got an author that's got his own page there, whatever. And the writing's in Hindi. You know, I mean, it's just amazing that like you create a thing that's sort of a side project, and now it's become a very useful tool. I know other people put short stories there and all that. And that was sort of a side. Oh, let me go do this kind of thing because it'll be fun. You know, Story Voice is having sort of a similar thing where I'm like, let me go create this thing for fun. And now I have writers, people using this sort of stuff. And I've got a new side project thing that.
Well, and that's the best feeling is when you've created a thing and people are using it. And then they start coming up with applications that even you hadn't even considered for it. Or they say something that it's like you slap your forehead. You're like, no, of course, dummy. That's what this always wanted to be. For example, on the Scam School shoot, you know, the whole reason we do the premium high-end puzzle boxes with each release of a deck of new cards is that the margins on a single deck of premium cards are not very great. They're very expensive to make. We can't afford to do, you know, dozens of thousands at once. So we have to do small runs of 5,000 at a time. And that means you know, there's a lot of prestige associated with it. I'm proud of them. The art is good. They're fun, and they're great to work with. But I was like, there needs to be an experience that is premium. And so, taking a cue from Theory 11, they would oftentimes when they released a new deck of cards have a premium collector's edition stuff, whether you know do a box or whatever. So we had the idea to do the puzzle box with the Arcana artifact. And then it's like, well, that really went over well. It was our single biggest thing that we ever sold. So it's like, well, let's try something similar with the new cards, the Outlaws, and let's do it with the Outlaws Relic. And then we did it again with what I think is our best effort yet this holiday season. Yeah, the Outlaws Vault is the most complicated. It's the biggest by size. It's the most intricate, hardest puzzle to solve. Unless you get one of the units that was seated wrong when it set out, in which case just reseat it and hopefully it'll be fine. It wasn't until the whole reason these puzzle boxes exist is because I was trying to figure out a way. How do I take a $12 to $15 premium item and make it a bigger experience that's worthy
partially commoditized
of $100 to $200 or $150, right? And then somebody was asking, like, would you ever consider doing a puzzle box without a deck of cards inside? Because I was, you know, something that I could put something, I could put a present into. And then all of a sudden I was just like, holy crap, that's a good point. Wait, yeah, I could just sell an awesome puzzle box working with, because along the way we built up relationship with the manufacturers. This guy really knows his stuff. He does quality work. And I was like, that would be brilliant. So, you get caught up in a, like, who am I and what do I do? Oh, I make decks of cards. Well, now I'm making them fancy decks of cards. But it's like, well, why don't you not even do the cards part and instead just have the box? That's how scam stuff happened, is because we were writing the Scam School books as a way to monetize the presents from the Scam School brand. And then we sat down, you know, the problem was we'd sell out, but once everyone bought the book, they couldn't buy the book a second time. And after 3 years of doing that, it hit us one weekend, like, what if we sold something that we didn't have to spend 6 months writing in order to release it? What if we just, you know, found something really neat that we liked that had a decent little chunk of margin and just made it a really fun experience on the store? And so we pitched Scam Stuff, and the rest most people are familiar with. At any rate,
trapped up in your original idea.
Correct. Always be constantly questioning, like, why am I here and where are things going and what might it be if I wasn't tied to what I was doing? If I had no sunk costs in anything, what are all the things I would consider? What are the assets?
Mm-hmm. Or even just starting clean and just saying, like, hey, you know, I've been doing X project for now and I've iterated and I've done all of these phases or whatever, but what if I was starting it again from the ground up today? What things would I change? And sometimes that can be enough of an energy boost to make you go over the hump of making hard decisions, of totally rewriting something from the very beginning, or saying, you know, cutting these things and we're making this cleaner, sleeker, faster, whatever. Like, you know, don't be afraid to step back and say, what if I just started over? Because the second time you do something will almost certainly be better than the first time you do it.
100%. Right. I was looking through all of the stuff on Scam Stuff and I was amazed just the amount of quantity and stuff you have there. And customs, I mean, I just watching where that started from and looking where it is now, it's impressive. And Bryce's point, your point absolutely was something I wanted to say earlier. Like, yeah, the second time you go at it, if you learn, and the key is to learn. Often people don't learn. They don't know what happened, why things worked, or whatever. They attribute way too much to luck or their own expertise, and it's often inverse. My thing is to assess your skills. It's to say there's things I like to do, then there are things that I want to do. You know, people ask me, you know, what's my dream job? You know, managing a strip club on a space station. But, you know, until then,
20,
you know,
30 years, we got time. We got time.
Yeah, I know. Start petitioning.
Not ruling that out. But
you're going to need a lot of poles, though. Like, it's going to be all poles.
You think they make spaceships with a lot of poles, though, because of the gravity.
Well, yeah. Okay.
It's a spinning space station. I forgot that part.
Oh, yeah.
Or not all the time. I don't know.
Man, you know what? Actually, I'm thinking about all the body parts that would.
Zero-G Friday.
It's not just going to be women. There's going to be a section of dudes, too, whatever. Sure. It's for everybody, you know. So.
Well, I know. That's what I mean. Exactly. Plenty of body parts that are going to react differently in microgravity.
Everybody comes to see. In all seriousness, because I have to say that was I'm joking.
Meanwhile, you just get you get a text. It's a PayPal payment from Elon. Who's watching? He's like,
make it happen.
Yeah, go start.
I I think you need to take an assessment and say, what are you good at? Sit down on the piece of paper and say, what am I good at? And by good at means not like, oh, I like doing this thing, but are you really good at it? And
A different way to think of it, the phrase that I did when I quit my day job is I thought, what are my natural gifts? What is easy for me that is harder for some other people? And does that matter in what I'm doing?
But some of it can be things you've developed. Like I would say that half the things I would write down were things that like I couldn't write a novel 10 years ago. I couldn't code. And I'm not like a great coder, but I'm really good at like, how would you do this? Like, all right, I will show you a way to do this. And an experienced coder would be like, oh my God, why did you do it that way? I'm like, because there was no solution out there and I had to come up with one. Yeah. But so I say, you put these things and I say, what am I? But I'm not like, if I wanted to create a company, like I would not base it on my ability as a coder, you know? But my point is though, is like, I get it. I understand these things. I know that. I'm pretty good in sales in the room when it comes to pitching big things. So I'm like, I'm good at that. And putting those sort and understanding what people need to know to make a decision. So I say, like, you sit down and figure out what are you good at? What do you have the energy for? And then, you know, if I were Bryce, but let's say I was a slightly alternate universe version of Bryce and I love music, I'd say, you know, I love music and I love creating my stuff, but I really get production. And now, but instead of me just telling people, hey, I'm going to lease out my services as a studio engineer, whatever. I'm going to create my own label. And everybody can like, oh, anybody can create your own label. Yes, anybody can create your own label. Anybody can write a book. But how you do it could be totally different. Be like, you know what? I'm going to look for people within 100 miles, 200 miles of Austin, within a trip or thing. And then I'm going to say, hey, I will produce this album for you. And I'm going to put you on a bill with some other people. And I'm going to manage and produce whatever kind of thing.
And that's a very good example today because the value of labels – is so much more diminished compared to a decade or two decades ago, where nowadays they're either, you know, they used to be a bank. They would help pay to get your stuff recorded and give you promotion and stuff, where nowadays the most effective thing your label can do is help put you in touch with other artists and other acts because anybody can make a music video on YouTube. Anyone can make a video on their iPhone. We were talking at the end of Weird Things of like there's all sorts of music accessories. It's easier than ever to get into the production side and it's easier than ever to do promotion. So what you need from someone, you know, if you're giving someone a stake in your in the specific example is they need to be a connection. They need to help put bridges together. And so it's a matter of like understanding what unique value you can provide, not just what it is that you like to do.
Yeah. Look at it. It's saying that like, oh, and this is a thing where it might be like a lot of people could do this, but they're not. They're not the ones organizing it and putting it together.
Can I tell you the goofiest thing?
No, Brian, it's not.
There was a moment, what was it, doing a gig, and I've got like, you know, four trunks that are coming off on the luggage stuff. And I'm at this one side, you know, we're all gathered around gate four where the luggage is coming out or we're waiting for the luggage to come out.
The carousel there.
Right. Yeah. But it's gate three, the light comes on, and then very clearly the luggage is coming out, and it's pretty obvious that one of two things, either for whatever reason, we've all been standing at the wrong one, or it's another flight. Nothing's happening at the one that we're at. So nobody, and meanwhile, something's happening over here. I don't know whether or not that's going to turn out to have my luggage or not. But it occurs to me I have nothing to lose by walking over there and cozying up so that the moment it comes off, I can get it and be first to get my luggage. And I was astonished because virtually nobody else did until they started recognizing their stuff. And then they walked over. And I was like, we all spent that same block unit of time. We were all equally capable of walking over and taking that risk. And yet, you know, in that moment, I was the only one who was like, well, you know, who knows? Let's see. And I put myself in a position to be the one, you know, I had a crummy spot on the old one, but then I took a risk and invested and went over there and happened to get it. And it occurred to me that so much of business and making it as an entrepreneur is just doing that. Just, you know, like, yes, anybody could, but just be one of the people who will.
Yeah, and you know, applying a little thought to it. My favorite example is Dumb and Dumber, the bus at the end, the Hawaiian Tropic bus stops. Like, oh, we're looking for a couple of towel boys to lather us down and da-da-da-da. And they're like, you know, you know, wow, what a couple of lucky guys are going to get that job. Maybe you'll find somebody that way, because they just don't think, oh.
Because you have blinders on. It never even occurs to them.
Yeah, and like you often you'll hear like, you know, you come up with an idea and people are like, well, why doesn't, you know, well, what if the such and such company does this? Like, well, that company wants to do it. They can do anything, you know, but are they? And the fact that somebody could go in there and you could be have competition is not a reason. Like, you know, Uber's not a sophisticated company when it comes to technology. Uber's worth $60, $70 billion. Like, well, I want to create a company where you pull out your phone and you get a car, but the car is just driven by a part-time driver. Oh, nobody's going to want, you know, a part-time driver driving them. You know, you can think of all the reasons why nobody would want to do that. You know, Airbnb, like, oh, what if I rented out my room? Like, what if you get a psychopath there? What if you get this? Yes, life is filled with risks.
Yeah.
But, you know,
and I guess that's the funny part is now Airbnb is in a place where they have enough money where part of the Airbnb experience, I mean, do they offer insurance? Do they help you mitigate those risks now? Like, are you able to pay within their system or something? I would imagine.
I would imagine. So, but
yeah. Maybe. I mean, certainly,
that
like,
clicks into weird realty things that they want to avoid.
Yeah, maybe. But you know, but regardless, it's like, you know, I'm not saying be irresponsible, but man, there's risk always, and I understand that it's very seductive to believe that there's no risk in anything. But it's a lie, and in your heart, you know it's a lie. So why not just be comfortable with risk, and then just the conversation. A friend of mine, a mentalist, Christopher Carter. When I was first getting started, he was nice enough to spend like an hour talking to me on the phone, and he was really excited. He was like, "Man, I've got for the first time ever two shows booked every single day of the week: a morning show or a nooner and an evening show booked every single day for 2 weeks straight at a bunch of colleges." And I'm like, well, where is it? And he was like, oh, Minnesota. And I'm like, well, when is it? He was like, oh, like February. I'm like, wait a minute. You booked that. What if there's snow? What if you don't make it to a show? And he's like, well, then I would imagine I won't be paid for those. And it was like, to me, that was like the most horrifying thing. Like, I would never book all that much work. What if you didn't make it? And the answer is like, well, if you don't make it, then you don't get paid.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, pretty great that I have 14 gigs booked, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to change the mindset. And, you know, we get so accustomed to success stories because also if you're the person that has the success, you want to sort of suggest that it was predestined because it makes you feel more secure. It doesn't make it feel like it's as fleeting. Particularly in entertainment, you hear these success stories. It was meant to be because of this, because it gives you comfort because you realize how fleeting, how fast things and fortunes can change. Jeff Bezos drove the first batches of books to the post office himself, drove them from the warehouse to where they were fulfilling them. They had their living room filled with card tables. He gave up. He had a really good job in New York, you know, good Wall Street job. He was making good money, but he had a vision. He said, I'm going to follow this through. He came from a good family, not a super wealthy family at all. You know, adopted, by the way, you know, has that kind of whole sort of, you know, or different, you know, interesting relationship with the father or whatever. But anyhow, Bezos was a guy that had to go through. If you looked at what he went through the early stages, none of us would do this. Not none of us, but I'm saying very few people would. And I use this example all the time. What's the difference between Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Mark Zuckerberg and everybody else? The day they became a billionaire, they still showed up at work. It wasn't like, I'm going to make a billion and then I'm out. If you have that mentality, unless you run some sort of con or get super, super lucky, you're never going to get there because you're just looking for each opportunity to exit. And you might get an early exit where it's like, ah, it's a couple million dollars. You know what? I'm happy. I'm good to go. But if you're just going to change the world.
Have you noticed in almost every entrepreneurial documentary, there's always that one guy who they interview who did cash out at $1 million?
Oh, yeah.
And he was like, no, I'm not bitter. You know, it's like I couldn't have taken the company in the direction he did to make it that big.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that's not what I wanted to do. I just wanted to make a little company where somebody could drive other people around. And that's why I sold my shares.
Yeah,
where is this in a character in this documentary?
I don't know. I'm half channeling. I can't remember where I heard it most recently. But it was the UFC, the 30 for 30 documentary. Right. They did a thing on the UFC. UFC was created by one guy who's just like, I just want to see what happens when a Taekwondo guy takes on a Judo guy, taking on a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guy. And then you know, somebody after the fact came in. You know, the first episode pay-per-view event was kind of a show, but also it was it did well, and somebody saw the potential and then bought him out. And then the guy – and meanwhile, UFC is one of the biggest thing ever. He was like, oh, no, I just thought it would be cool. I'm okay with it.
I mean, what do you want, though? Like, you don't want that person to be like, I really messed up.
Oh, no. But
you know, like, you have to – like, that's – especially when you have a near miss of that size, you have to – be positive about it. And there's no benefit.
Oh, no. And I'm sure he's genuinely nothing but happy, but just be aware. Like, ask yourself if, you know, getting $1 million and being the footnote guy in the documentary is okay with you. And I'm betting a lot of people, maybe 99% of everyone listening right now, are like, that sounds like a pretty great end to my story, is getting paid $1 million and being a piece of something that becomes gigantic and huge. Yeah. But somewhere out there is the 1% that I'm like, that are like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I do want to do that. But then again, you know, that's fraught with peril and folly, and you might screw it up.
Pebble.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember when I invested in Apple way early days, right? And then I'm watching the stock fluctuate. And I'm like, and my friend's like, oh, we should sell a tie. And then you should do this. I sold some. And then I'm like, I watch it go low again. And I'm like, I guess I'll buy it. And back and forth. And then I'm like, it was stressing me out. I'm like, I'm not day trading is dumb. Unless you're like a supercomputer. Two, I'm not a day trader. I don't have the mentality for that. You know, like, I'm just going to buy it, hold on to it, and that's it. Sell it when I need to. And I realized, like, and also, I knew the people that were trying to do the day trading kind of thing. They're all people playing poker and all this. They're really bad at estimating their winnings and stuff like this too. Like I would hear some of the dumbest things from them. Like, oh, I use a strategy. What is like, I bet on a stock in it going up, and then what happens? Like, well, if I lose the next day, I place twice as much as a bet or whatever? And you're like, that's mathematically idiotic. And you would see people do that. You know, and there was like in the 90s, there was a big thing, day trading centers. People would go there to day trade. You know, which was just nothing against day traders. I'm sure there are people who've done well by it, but. Anyhow, but I was in, a long, I in had to, like, general, it's long term.
Yeah, in general, I think it is. What is it? The efficient market hypothesis that basically says, look, the stock market is as efficient as a market as you will ever find, and if you're winning, you know, it by the numbers is almost certainly because you're lucky.
Yeah, well, I mean, the exceptions would be, and I have a friend who's a business professor, and I've gotten into this. You know, he's like, oh, well, he's like, you know, you're never going to outperform the market. I'm like, I do, but, you know, I do in the way that, like, you know, I don't. If you say go invest money today, I won't, because I could tell you right now, there's not a company that I go that I felt like I did about Pixar, that I felt about Tesla or Apple or, you know, the company. When every company I've ever put more than $1,000 into, I've more than doubled my money, right? But I follow these companies for years and then go, okay, I'm going to get into it. It's, you know, modified value investing by Benjamin Graham. I look for the information deficiency. I look at where, you know, like there's the misjudgment or the judgment of whatever, you know, and do that. But
sorry, we got a bit on a side jag there. You're like, let's talk about other investment strategies.
Jim Cramer comes out and
my point is that like anything is that like, yeah, a lot of success is just random. Somebody's randomly going to win that, but there are people who consistently come out ahead. Warren Buffett. Okay. Bezos, the way that he managed his company, the way he did that, you know, Elon, there are some people, it's comforting for some people to go like, no. And I get like the mark, like, yeah, you can't, like, there's like, if people want you to invest in like a more, you know, like five Morningstar funds outperform this. Yeah. 95 did worse, you know, whatever. It's like, it's dumb, but you can learn. You can become a better business person. You can make better decisions that improve your odds. You don't get perfect odds, but you can get better at that by understanding where are people acting irrationally, where can you act rationally.
So when do we want to schedule our, like we said, not resolutions, but forward thinking goals? Because we spent today talking about how to properly assess where you are and where you came from and what you got. But next week, you want to preemptively get a jump on the resolution people?
Sure.
Cool.
Sure. We want to hear from you guys. We want to hear from our listeners out there. Questions, challenges, goals, questions. Am I being realistic or not? Whatever. I think everybody be willing, dream big and act big. You know, I've got a couple things in the work that I can't wait to talk about that are like absolutely stupid things that I've had other people go along with now that are like, sounds great. And I'm like, I should keep my mouth shut, but
you got any picks? I have a reverse pick.
I got a pick.
All right.
So I was doing this big marathon stream yesterday, 12 and a half hours.
What?
And I think I've done 14 before. I've done these marathon streams before. They're a lot of fun. They're very tiring. But I was using it as a chance to play a bunch of games I had never played. I hadn't played this year. Because you go and buy games and you on sale or whatever. And I was really taken by King's Quest, the 2015 new version of King's Quest.
Oh, of the original, the remake of the original.
I don't know that it's a remake necessarily.
Oh, I thought it was. I thought they did updated art and made it all.
Well, this is all 3D.
Oh, shoot. Well, maybe this is a new one.
Yeah, and it's it's like a 3D version of the classic puzzle genre. And at first, I was really concerned because I've played a lot of Telltale games and other adventure games like Life is Strange recently. And the bummer about those games is that they're not exactly puzzle games. They're like interactive storytelling, basically, which is fine. But that also can mean that they're pretty short and not necessarily really challenging or stimulating. And while King's Quest definitely has a lot of the classic logical leaps of old Sierra and old Lucas adventure games, I think what was really nice about it was that, A, it's episodic, but the first chapter that we played through was like 4 hours long, which is pretty long for those types of games, or rather for an episodic game. But it was also really stimulating, and it offered a lot of choice and uncertainty that was pretty engaging. And on top of that, it looks really nice. A lot of hand drawn stuff, including like little particle effects when there's water. The splashes will be hand drawn water effects, and the voice performances are fantastic. Christopher Lloyd is in it.
Oh wow!
Doc Brown plays the old version of the king, I believe.
It's okay.
Like, there's like this framing narrative where it's like the old version of the king is telling the story to his granddaughter. And so whenever you die, it's like, Grandpa, you didn't die. Or it's like, you know, well, that's what I would have done if I pulled the left switch.
That was first time I saw that was in the Prince of Persia, the very first one with the time dynamic. You could rewind time.
Oh, yeah, same
and then
time.
When you would die, you would just hear the prince go, wait, that's not what happened. and then he backs it up.
Yeah, and there's like a lot of different stuff like that. There's still some weirdly – I only played the first chapter. I still have the other four to kind of get into. But it was nice to see an episodic game like that and see the amount of attention to both the performances and the actual gameplay elements. That was pretty nice. I think there's a lot of junk about it, right? There's a lot of walking around. There's a lot of just – banging your head against the wall to figure out what do I do with this strudel, right? but overall, it was really cool, and I would really recommend the new King's Quest game.
So,
new.
I watched the documentary featuring lots of behind the scenes footage of the making of Man on the Moon, the Jim Carrey. I guess quasi biopic of the Andy Kaufman story.
Andy Kaufman, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's on Netflix. It's called Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond. It's what, about an hour long. And I was really struck by about halfway through how much I really wanted to punch Jim Carrey.
Wow.
Just because, and maybe that's the hallmark of it being good art or whatever, but a big, first of all, if you're not familiar, Andy Kaufman's story is extraordinary and wonderful and incredible and shocking and all this stuff. I watched every documentary I could. Was it I'm From Hollywood? Is that one of the ones about the wrestling stuff? And then I was really excited for Man on the Moon when it came out. I was disappointed that Man on the Moon, the movie, really was just a bunch of Jim Carrey recreating all of Andy Kaufman's best bits with very, very little detail of what it must have been like behind the scenes and all that stuff. And that was disappointing. But I had heard all of the stories of Jim Carrey, you know, method acting, staying in character after the cameras were over and so on. And that's what this is all about. And I think this made me just hate method actors. Just hate everybody who plays pretend when the cameras aren't on. It's just – you just see how taxing it is for everybody around because the shoot's over and he's continuing to play pretend to be someone he's not. And yes, I'm sure it's easier to play pretend to be Andy Kaufman when you're doing it all the time always. But meanwhile, it's like, wouldn't a better actor be able to be civil after the shoot was over and not continue to pretend to be this total asshat the whole time? But I talked about it on Twitter, and some people agreed with portions of what I said. Some people said, wow, it's amazing that we could both look at the same piece of art and I could come away seeing somebody who's was at a very troubling crossroads in his acting career, having a meltdown essentially. And I was like, wow, man. And I countered with like, well, he sure does look proud of himself with every, you know, crap eating grin that we see him, you know, recounting this adventure 20 years later. So I implore the listeners to give it a watch and see which side you come on. Is this a good guy doing good acting, going through a tough time? Or is it a selfish, smug a piece of work who, you know, is, oh, man, the part that just drove me nuts is how proud he is when he's talking to, I think it's Andy Kaufman's sister, in character as Andy Kaufman. And I'm like, you're a real – and I think he says something to the effect of like, yeah, it was really great to give her that gift of, you know, just, you know, seeing her brother again. And I was just like, didn't care for it. Didn't care for it. Didn't care for that attitude, sir. But you guys should watch it.
Okay. It's a tricky thing, man, because like, yeah, I don't know. You know, what I've read and understand, like, you know, kind of method is like, I objectively speaking, I haven't noticed that there is necessarily a qualitative difference between them. Method seems to be what inexperienced actors often glom on to when they're trying to do that. And there's some actors I think are really good, but you notice, I don't want to name any names, but that will do things like always have a gimmick. They got to have a gimmick, you know, like a prosthetic or something like this so they can feel the character, feel the role kind of thing. But yeah. Jim Carrey's an interesting guy. He's a guy that's just – he's had a very difficult childhood, very, very traumatic childhood, and he's always had difficulty sort of trying to adjust and sort of fit in. And amazingly talented guy though. I wish we'd see more of him, but totally understand what you're saying. My pick, man, I'm just going to pass. I'm going to double down on the past, everything else.
Cool.
You know, I'm still in the middle of every audiobook that I was reading before. I'm still in the middle of watching, you know, the Doctor Who when I'm like been programming. So I'm like kind of just been, nothing new to add.
Cool. I had a really good time at the Scam School shoot chatting with another reader of The Naturalist and geeking out over.
Oh, yeah. Y'all had a nice little chat off of the side for a while about.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about this here. I'm going to make your pick for you. It's The Naturalist. I made the case that I think The Naturalist is your best work that I've read. Because while I really enjoyed the Jessica Blackwood stuff, I couldn't tell how much of my affection was for finally seeing magic represented well, because magic is so precious to me and so many people get it wrong and you got it right, you know, the world of illusions and so on. Whereas The Naturalist, there was none of that that I was inherently drawn to. And the fact that I got sucked in so deeply to that experience convinced me, like, I think this is Andrew. This is – I can definitely vouch that it's my favorite work that you've done so far.
Well, I appreciate it. And I think that also it's kind of like once we get out of a domain, you and I know a lot about magic or whatever, you can just sort of read me as a writer and not a guy taking all this magic background and all that and putting it into there. So –
yeah.
Cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot. Groovy. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.